beginning of time, our very humanity has been based on connecting at the cellular level. Today, connecting on a cellular level has taken on a different meaning.
Welcome to the third season of the No App for Life podcast. I'm Joni Ciani, and I'm so glad that you're with us again. This is the podcast where we have that honest conversation about the digital world and how it's impacting our real world and really shaping an entire population, an entire generation that we just, when everything started, we weren't really anticipating this level of impact on social development, on communication skills, on soft skills, and on relationships. And it's been tragic to hear stories from Kristen Bride about her son Carson, who ended up being cyberbullied again. So crazy that it's from people that he was saying, "These are my friends." What does communicating on social media do to us as that person who's sending messages? There's this weird dissociative thing that happens to us where we're not even, you know, connecting with our own behavior or having an empathetic understanding because we don't pick up cues from other people. Judy and Joanne told their stories of both of their sons, and this was such a long time ago. And I remember when these stories were happening with these choking challenges, I thought something has to happen, right? I mean, this was so many years ago, and they're still happening. And again, I'm bringing in Gene Rogers here, the director of the Screen Time Action Network, who had the idea to get these stories out there in a fuller way so that these parents feel like they are being heard, their stories are being told, and understood, most importantly, the whole story, not just showing up as a statistic at a hearing. And Gene, this was such a good idea for you to have. So thank you again.
Thank you, Joni. I'm very happy to be here with No App for Life. And when I approached you about these stories, I realized these parents had come to us at the Screen Time Action Network, and they were ready to collaborate with each other to make change so that other families didn't understand their tragedy, could understand their tragedy. But they had to tell the story over and over again and relive that grief. And I said, these stories should really be recorded so that they'll be able to use them when they're asked and not have to go through that every single time.
It is a process of re-traumatizing, right? Every time you have to tell the story. And as we're doing the stories, it was, you know, I had the lump in my throat. I had to, you know, really pull back quite a bit when you really put yourself into the shoes of a family who has gone through the loss of a child needlessly. And as you said in one of our earlier intros, Gene, you used that word ruthless and insidious. And it's still so shocking that after all these years, that there were so many of us. We're not the only, you know, it seems like all of a sudden it came to the front when Frances Haugen came out with Facebook, and we're like, the research has been there, you know, the research has been there for a long time, and you've had your organization who has been fighting since the first days of YouTube coming out and kids, and it gets very, very frustrating to still feel like we're still being kind of victimized by big tech. And we don't have a lot to, you know, to change.
We are, Joni, and our voices are getting louder. Mm. I have hope because these families have organized. They have come to us and said, we'd like to have some support. We're happy to give them the support. You're happy to tell their stories. And so that's how we're going to facilitate change. Mm. It's kind of a supercharged issue that no one wants to talk about.
Right.
And here we are, we're bringing it to the forefront because it needs to be discussed. We have to stop allowing these corporations to control kids, to make money off their depression, their anxiety, increase their anxiety. And we have to give families back their children.
Mm. Yeah, it's so important. In this third series here, I was shocked. I cannot believe how much I learned. And I think I'm up to speed on a lot of this because I get a lot of information from my students. We're talking about the access to purchasing drugs online, recreational drugs, not prescription drugs. We're talking about kids that can order drugs like they order a pizza to show up at their front door. Were you surprised at this? I mean, you're going, isn't there some law against that? But what were you understanding when that story came to you?
Joni, I was shocked. When I first heard about kids accessing drugs online, it made me think, how might this have happened in the past? So in person, you know, through the back door of a restaurant or a convenience store or down the street, it was not happening online. Essentially, the unregulated internet has created a superhighway for these drug dealers, and geolocator software has made it possible for them to gain access to our precious children. And kids don't know, again, developmentally, they don't understand that this thing that looks like candy is going to end my life for good. Right. They don't understand developmentally, and they're being lured by these drug dealers online.
Lured when they're putting up advertisements, you know,
yes,
that they're advertising. Oof. I'm like, this is so questionable to me. And, you know, we can get into the regulations, and, you know, Jean and I are dedicated to making sure that we're giving voice to the families that have been affected by this. And I wanted to thank you again for listening, because it's hard to tell the stories, but it's even harder sometimes to listen and understand that there's this impact out there that's happening. And we feel awfully vulnerable to it. So, Jean, thank you again for connecting with us on this. And let's hear from Debbie. I'm so sorry to have to make you tell it again, because I know it's re-traumatizing. But fill me in, first of all, as a parent who was going through this, trying to make the right decision.
It was difficult. I mean, it was really difficult because back when my kids were around in sixth, seventh grade or so, at that time, their friends started having phones. It was not something that my husband and I wanted to see our kids have. All of a sudden, we found ourselves in this situation where everyone else was doing it, and if we didn't allow our kids to be on these apps or have a smartphone, they were going to be left out and left behind. So it was really hard.
Yeah, I remember it very, very clearly, and feeling like an outlier and not sure. But it just, and it was interesting when I even started looking, when we started looking into this, 2006, you know, when I was teaching interpersonal communication, I was watching the way students were trying to navigate this new world that we just threw at them. And it was such a powerful tool. Expose people, using it as a weapon if you're mad at somebody. I could not get over it.
Even before my kids were born, my husband and I had conversations about this, because we grew up sitting in front of our TVs,
right,
you know, all day long. And we did not want our kids to do that. Mm-hmm. The irony, I feel, in this, given what ended up happening, it just gave us a bad feeling. Our kids having something with them 24/7 that constantly required their attention in their minds, right? Because if you have this phone with you and someone can be texting you at any time, then you, a piece of your brain is always thinking about, did I just get a text? Did who just texted me? Do I need to get on there and reply?
It was a hijacking, a mental hijacking.
It is, exactly. And I felt a little bit like that's what happened to me as a kid. It was too easy to be hijacked by TV. But that doesn't, you can't even put that in the same category as having a phone with you that is with you 24/7, that is a connection to other kids and to what other kids are doing, and what's going on. What am I missing? We did not want to feel like we were preventing them from being part of the social network. And what ended up happening is eventually social media turned my daughter's world upside down and ours through her. And this started a downward spiral. Originally, her difficulties began when a friend invited a group of 18-year-old boys from another town to join their party chat. These party chats were very popular at the time, and you just needed to be invited into a group, and then you're part of it, even though you don't really know these kids. They're from another town. And so after a few weeks of online chatting, the boys invited the girls to a small party at one of their houses, and they served the girls, who were 15 at the time, they served them alcohol. My daughter had not had much experience with alcohol prior to this, and she became intoxicated. In this state, one of the boys took her outside and raped her. Within a few months after that, some 15-year-old girls from her high school used their phones to cyberbully my daughter. And it got around the school what happened to my daughter, and they, in a separate incident, they used a separate incident to cyberbully her and call her names and just be cruel to her. And she was just thrown for a loop between these two events, and she eventually looked to drugs as a way to ease her pain. Becca's particular journey was marred by these two traumatic events, and they led her to use drugs to dull her pain. It was a devastating and humiliating experience, and she wanted to find a way out of those horrible feelings. And first it was marijuana, then it was other drugs. And at first, some friends gave her drugs, and then eventually she was able to figure out how to buy them on her own through Snapchat. It was so accessible.
It's so crazy how accessible that can be.
It's incredible. Yeah, drug dealers called plugs on social media can send out ads based on zip code. I mean, that's how Snapchat works. You send out an ad, it goes to everyone in this zip code. They don't know the age or circumstances of the people who are getting this. It's just, you're in that zip code, you're a kid, you look at your feed and there's an ad. And, you know, there might be a picture of an actual electrical plug. That's which represents a plug who's dealing drugs. And then a kid just swipes up and they're connecting with the plug or drug dealer. They make arrangements to either have the drugs mailed or meet the plug out down the street. My daughter would walk the dog. would say, oh, I'm going to go walk the dog. And she'd meet up with someone, or she would sneak out in the middle of the night and meet her plug down the street. And she could get anything she wanted almost 24/7. She could have anything she wanted. And short of us locking her in her room, there wasn't a lot we could do about it. And of course, you know, we didn't know it when much of this was happening. Once we learned, we had her go to treatment, but I mean, that's a whole other subject we could probably talk for hours on, and the ways that the treatment, particularly for teens, is lacking, in accessibility and in what's out there to help kids get over this. And once a child is using drugs, because their brains are still developing, right, the brain is so susceptible to being altered by the drugs. I mean, literally the neural pathways get altered. And once this happens, it takes a teen a very long time for their brain to heal. I've been told a year. And so you're talking about keeping a child away from the drugs for an entire year for their brain to heal. How do you do that?
Right.
If they're not in a residential program for a year, how do you do that? Because you can't do that without locking them in their room if they're at home.
Yeah.
And residential programs are generally, insurance pays for maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and that's it. And then your kid is out. Yeah. So the system just isn't working for them.
Right. And then I know it was some of the drugs that she could have access to, are so severe, you know, you don't know what you're getting.
Right. And that's a problem that is just getting worse and worse, because fentanyl has become, it's just everywhere. It's in everything now.
Can you tell that part of the horrific part of your story just so, again?
Yeah.
We're doing this. We're doing this podcast, and we're recording this, and we want to have these stories told so that you're not having to re-traumatize yourself,
right,
every time you need to tell somebody this. That's one of the reasons why we're doing this little project.
I appreciate that. Thank you. So Becca was in and out of treatment the last 8 months of her life. She was 18, and because she was 18, she was in adult facilities, which was not where she belonged. She was also in co-ed facilities and trying to get healed while in a place where, you know, where she was surrounded by men as well as other women. It was not optimal. And like many others, she would spend 2-3 weeks there. They'd let her out. She might spend a week off of drugs, and then she'd be back on. And that's very typical. So anyway, she was, it was during one of those periods where she was not using most things at the time. She had a medical marijuana card and was allowed because of, she had physical ailments and pain. But she knew that the minute she started using anything else, she had to go back to treatment. And she and a friend were both in this situation, and we found out they were drinking. So the next day, they were going to go back to treatment. They were each going to go to a different place. Well, that night, they were able to get a hold of some drugs. They both wanted to have one last night of doing something. They wanted to try something called a speedball that they had never done before, and it's heroin and cocaine. She had never done heroin before, but she had done cocaine. And so the two of them were able to they managed to find the drugs. We weren't even in our hometown. We were someplace else because we didn't want her near her drug dealers. But they were able to find the drugs. And
Online?
So here's where that particular time, I know that they, one of them was able to get in touch with friends through Facebook, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a situation like Snapchat where Becca used to generally get her drugs.
Wow.
My understanding is that they, you know, a friend of a friend all going through Facebook connections. Mm-hmm. They were finally able to, it was within a couple of hours of knowing they were going to go into rehab the next day. They were able to find the drugs that they wanted. And in the middle of the night, they locked the bedroom door, the two of them together, and they started using these drugs. Well, it turns out that the drugs were laced with fentanyl, which is becoming more and more common. There, you know, the number of deaths, it's everywhere now. The girls did not know. I only know from the other girl who did survive that they didn't know that there was fentanyl in the drugs. Fentanyl is much stronger than heroin. So they didn't know what they were getting. They were inexperienced, and it killed Becca. By the time in the morning when I knocked on the door and it was locked, she was already gone. I called the police. They came. They broke down the door, and she was gone. Her friend was taken to the hospital. She survived. She spent much of the next year recovering both cognitively and physically from the damage from her overdose. So... And she's considered the lucky one. And who, I don't even know, you know, do you ever fully recover from that? I don't know.
I don't think you do. I mean, no. Not that level of trauma. You get through, through, and I'm sure... You know, how are you, your other daughter, how's Sam, how's the rest of the people in your family, how do you get through?
It's been difficult. We're fortunate in that we have family and friends here, very supportive community, but every day you wake up and you don't know, is it going to be a good day or is it a bad day? I think about Becca. There's not a minute that goes by just about that I don't think about Becca. Everything I do now is somehow connected to her, to try and honor her memory. It's hard. There's guilt, you know, if only. Mm. There's so many things to say, if only, about.
And I'm sure there's anger there too, you know?
Oh, a lot.
Right.
Yeah, and I go through periods, particularly probably the first 6 months or so. There were periods of such extreme anger and anger toward different people, of course, there's the social media apps. And when you think about the cyberbullying issue, which is so devastating, Becca... her trauma from that was just, it was awful. And,
the pain, right?
And what gets done
Right.
You know,
and knowing that Becca was in this level of pain, you know, that from the cyberbullying, and so heartbreaking to see. And we've had other people that we've talked to on this podcast whose kids have been in such pain, they've turned to suicide.
Right.
You know, and it is absolutely infuriating.
It is.
We watch the Senate hearings, and in back of some congressional senator member, you've got some stats with bars, or, you know, I'm like, we're not stats. this is happening to families every day. When you look at those stats, and you know, for you to share your story, to give it the actual human impact rather than just seeing some stupid number on a chart behind a congressional member, I really want to thank you so much for being able to do this. And hopefully,
thank you for giving me the opportunity. It's,
you know,
these stories need to be told.
Right. And, you know, and if they're not being told on regular television and television news and morning magazine shows. You don't see a lot of this on the Today Show and Good Morning America. It's like, no, that's too depressing. We can't talk about it. And then, you know, having a lot of these shows and talk shows just at the end of everything going, and don't forget, follow me.
It's a force on the other direction. In the other direction, it's a force. And the claims that there's positive, you know, there's so much positive. You know, it's not all negative. There's so much positive, as if you could even compare the two things.
Debbie, as a parent, and we are seeing legislators and senators, and this is the first time we're finally kind of hearing some kind of bipartisan addressing of when you do hear about the suicide rates, the shaping impact on kids, the depression, the social anxiety. Maybe this would be the thing if we can appeal to what I was saying, like if you actually love your kids and grandchildren, feel like, will this do it?
If I'm being honest, I doubt it. I come from an environmental advocacy background. I've spent 15 years saying to people, it's your children and your grandchildren who are going to be, you know, most impacted by this. And I've seen very little of the kind of action that's needed in that area. And I don't have a lot of faith that we're going to see the right kind of action in this area, unfortunately. It's not easy to do. Mm. And I hate to be a downer, but I hope, you know, you look at Sandy Hook, you look at, again, the climate, you look at at what we've really known for all these years. You know, what's it going to take to see real action? I don't know. You know, at the state level, I'd love to see smartphones banned from schools. You know, I've started to talk to people about that. Just simply get them out of kids' hands for at least 6 days. I mean, 6 hours a day. Give them a break. That to me seems like low-hanging fruit.
The empathy that I have been going through, like looking at a kid just trying to fit in. I'm just trying to fit in. I'm just trying to have my friends. And if I'm not connecting in the way that we're supposed to be connecting today, I'm not going to fit in. And so putting myself through what we never had to, you know?
As
adults.
And you're asking kids, you're expecting kids to make good decisions about this when they're at the very stage of their lives where they're trying to figure out who they are, where everything is about, you know, being popular, or, you know, who my friends are. And you're expecting them to be able to say, nope, I'm not going to do this. Mm-hmm. I don't want social media. It makes me depressed and anxious. They're not going to do that.
Yeah. You know, social media is just not the right tool for human validation. We're not intimacy. It's the wrong tool. We just keep forgetting that it's the wrong tool. It's a really important story, and I'm really hoping that on however we can scale it. Indeed. And God bless what you're doing here to share everything. Thank you, Debbie.
Take care.
Thank you so much for listening to the NOAP for Life podcast. And again, thank you so much to Gene Rogers at Children's Screen Time Action Network. Gene, I want to make sure that people have an opportunity to get in touch with you and a little bit more about the network.
Joni, I'm so glad that No App for Life was able to give voice to these stories. Again, just remembering these are very involved parents. They talk with their kids about social media, about drugs, about these challenges, and it's still happening. So we're here to give them a voice, to give them a space. At the Screen Time Action Network, we have 7 work groups on different topics, and they're really the heart of the network, where if people want to get involved, if they want to take action, we will support that action. We will support you becoming a member of the network and becoming a member of a work group. So you join by visiting us at screentimenetwork.org. Membership is free. We have a great resource library where you can access some articles on the topics that you've heard here at No App for Life, and we would love to have you join us.
Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you next time right here on the No App for Life podcast.